So we're going to continue on with our study of the first canto. We're going to have a review of what we've covered in chapter 7. And you're my audience at the moment. We're going to look at a review of chapter 7. And we're going to cover some new ground in chapter 8. So, chapter 7, we looked at, what was chapter 7? You can tell me. We're looking at Ashwathama. What did Ashwathama do? Ashwathama killed the five sleeping sons of Draupadi. All right, and what happened after Ashwathama killed the five sleeping sons of Draupadi? He released the Brahmastra, and well, yes, but what happened before he released that Brahmastra? Arjuna chased him, yes. And then what happened? He released the Brahmastra, yes, trying to kill Arjuna.
But he didn't know how to withdraw.
Yes, he shouldn't have actually released that because he didn't know how to withdraw it, that's right. And how did Arjuna react to that? He wasn't sure what to do. So he prayed. He turned to Krishna for advice, and Krishna advised him to destroy that, neutralize the Brahmastra by with another Brahmastra. So Arjuna did that. Arjuna released his own Brahmastra, because the only way to neutralize a Brahmastra weapon, which is like a nuclear, almost more powerful than a nuclear bomb, the only way to neutralize that is with another Brahmastra weapon. So Arjuna released that, and he was able to retract them both. Now, Krishna advised Arjuna that such an aggressor should be killed. And what we looked at with a little bit of detail was reasons for and against the execution of Ashwathama. Now, of course, one of the first reasons to execute Ashwathama was that Arjuna promised someone that he would behead that aggressor. He promised Draupadi, who was the mother of the five sleeping sons. Then we see in verses 35 to 39, Krishna gives various reasons, you know, why he should be killed. So it's a reason in itself that Krishna is ordering Arjuna to kill. So of course, you know, if Krishna orders something, you have to do it. That's the final word, because he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's a very good reason. why he should be killed. And of course you can imagine how this is testing Arjuna, because there are orders not to execute him, and some of them are equally valid. So he deserves to be killed for his own good. There's another one of Krishna's reasons in verse 37. So verse 35, he killed innocent boys in their sleep. So that is according to the laws of mankind, breaking such religious codes, even in war, the death penalty should be there. He deserves to be killed for his own good. That by being killed in this lifetime, it means that in his next life, he doesn't have to suffer the reaction. He's an assassin or a murderer of Arjuna's family. So Krishna's telling Arjuna, he murdered, you know, members of your own family. So, you know, Arjuna being a Kshatriya, it's within his right to actually kill such an aggressor. There are six different types of aggressors. One who attacks your family members, he can be killed. Especially if one is a Kshatriya, or if one is not a Kshatriya, one may ask the Kshatriyas to go and kill that person. And of course, in verse 51, we see that Bhima also said that, you know, he should definitely be killed. And in conclusion, both Bhima and Krishna both advise that yes, Aswatthama should be killed. So there's six very solid reasons there. Now, as far as don't execute, verses 43 to 48 were given by Draupadi. And now, she says, before we actually discuss these verses, if we look at verse 49, that was given by Yudhisthira. And one of the things we can summarize Yudhisthira's statement, it's there in the purport, that you're indebted to the family of Dronacharya and therefore don't kill his son. In Yudhisthira's prayer there, he confirms that what Draupadi has said is correct. So we see that one of Arjuna's initial thoughts in verse 40 is that, you know, he's thinking that he perhaps there is some indebtedness, you know, and that there are reasons why perhaps we shouldn't just race in and kill him. So Arjuna is thinking that in verse 40, right? His thoughts are confirmed by Draupadi in these verses 40 to 43, which we'll look at in a minute. And then at the end, Arjuna's thoughts are confirmed again by Yudhisthira. And Yudhisthira sums up that what in Draupadi's statements, Yudhisthira is saying that there are six excellent qualities manifested by Draupadi, which is summarized as her being religious, just, merciful, non-duplicitous, glorious, and equal. Right, so that's it. So when we actually have a look at Draupadi's thoughts, her statements, we can see how the Acharyas have shown that, you know, certain verses reflect each of one of these six qualities. So we see that Vishwanath Chakravarti the core has actually what I've done is, you see here in blue writing, I've shown where Vishwanath Chakravarti the core and is showing the particular quality mentioned by Yudhisthira to prove that her statements are according to religious principles. So And then above them, in the black here, you see that how the Mayapur Institute has summarized 6 reasons. Alright, so they've summarized 6 reasons, and the qualities manifest by Draupadi in her words are sort of spread throughout them. You know, one quality is sometimes, in a couple of different statements. So we'll have a look. So, as we said, Arjuna's thoughts in verses 39 and 40, it's there in the purports and in the translation of verse 40, that the son of Arjuna's great teachers should be spared. That's his initial thoughts. And in verse 49, Yudhisthira confirms that yes, we are definitely indebted to the family of Dronacharya. They're a slightly different context, but basically confirming Arjuna's statements and backed up by Draupadi. So there's two things there. One, if you're indebted to the family of Dronacharya, that means you should, out of indebtedness, you should spare his son. That's how the debt is relinquished. One might say, yes, we're indebted to Dronacharya, but he's not present, so the debt's not there. No, but because the son is there, and as we will see in Draupadi's statements, that the son represents the father in different ways, therefore, yes, you're indebted, and because the son's here, the son should be spared. So these are the statements of both Yudhisthira and Arjuna. Now we look at it through Draupadi's eyes. One, we see that, you know, devotees are never unkind even to an enemy. In verse 43. And this represents the quality of piety, religiousness, faithfulness to Dharma. You know, basically release him. You know, the Brahmana is always a guru. This is the principle. So, religious principles, you don't create offences or you know, kill the Brahmanas. They're always guru. Now there's a discussion that we'll have on this as far as the difference between men and women, let's put it that way. Alright, very interesting discussion. We need more women to, you know, you need more women. Yeah. Alright. So, devotees are never unkind to the enemy, verse 43. And we see here in verse 48, it's an offence to the Brahminical order. Here, this quality, as stated by Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, it is generosity, or, you know, it's a glorious, or, you know, a sign of gloriousness or greatness on the part of Devaki. That's the good quality manifested, because she's desiring to benefit the hearers by sparing the Kshatriyas who want to kill a Brahmana's son. So she's benefiting them by her statement, and of course she's also just being very big hearted. You know, it's an offence to the Brahminical order, so she also doesn't want to create an offence to a great family. See in verse 44, the son represents his absent father, Drona. It's also there in verse 46, and a couple of qualities are manifested here. According to Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, it's correctness, that or just. She's being very just, you know, and correct. It's also showing the principle of mercy. It's being just because You know, his father taught you welfare, so that's also showing that indebtedness. And that, you know, they are in fact being indebted to Drona, and the son representing Drona, they shouldn't kill him. And mercy, the killing of the son who represents the absent father is like killing the wife. So, one, it's an offence to both Drona and the wife. So it's she's being very just. That you know, how wrong it would be that you know you've taken so much help from him and now you're not going to show any gratitude. So that's wrong. So let's be just. Let's be correct. Right? But also mercy, and not only that, not only is it incorrect and unjust, but what about the suffering? Because, you know, Dronacharya representing his father, that means by killing the son, she loses her husband twice. Once in the form of her husband, once in the form of the son who represents the husband. Right? So, for the son represents the absent father, there's two qualities being manifest, one towards Drona, one towards Kripi? Yeah, Kripi. And then we see that, you know, in verse 46, 47, mostly 47, do not let Drona's wife cry like me. it's showing the quality of being non-duplicious. It sort of joins on from the previous point, of course, that the son represents the father. But it's non-duplicious, an unwillingness to cause others pain. You know, the guru's family. You know, we have one standard for us and another standard for everyone else. So that, you know, that's the non-duplicious quality. Let's apply, you know, let's not do unto others what we wouldn't want them to do to us, like that. So that's the non-duplicious quality being there. And she'd be an equal also, that, you know, Kripi, the wife of Drona, Draupadi, is, she's also the mother of children. She's lost her sons, and considering that, the mother of Ashvatthama is in an equal position. She's also a mother, and then, you know, if she also loses her son, so she's placing herself in her shoes, being able to see things equally. So that's the quality of equality. So therefore we see six reasons. Devotees are never unkind even to an enemy. It's an offence to the Brahminical order in general. One may say Ashvatthama is a, you know, Brahma, Dwija Bandhu, but still he represents a father who, you know, whose qualities may not necessarily be doubted. So it's still an offence to the Brahminical community. It's also, it will cause suffering to the Brahmana's wife, who is one of the natural mothers, of course, which is also an offence to the Brahminical community. Not only is it a general offence to the Brahminical community, but you know, in particular, the particular Brahmanas involved, this family is particularly indebted to them, which makes it even more of an offence. And therefore, you know, for all of these different reasons, you know, Arjuna's initial thoughts is that the son of our great teachers should be spared, is confirmed. So don't do it it's against the very qualities of a religious devotion, you know, a religious person, a Vaishnav. There's certainly an offence to the Brahminical order represented, you know, by the son of the Brahmana. And that offence is general and personal, and therefore, and one, you know, they should not do it. So that way we see Yudhisthira's, in verse 49, how he sums up the six qualities of Draupadi, and therefore confirms that all her qualities are, you know, very glorious and wonderful and totally religious, the qualities of a great personality. It is these wonderful qualities which is, you know, she has based her statements upon, which are all, you know, very religious and pious, so therefore he confirmed it. Now, of course, the fact that here in verse 49, Arjuna and Yudhisthira's reasons are very similar, but we have to consider that Yudhisthira is confirming himself, and that's reason enough because he's Dharmaraj. You know, so although their arguments are similar, the fact that he's saying it, who's Dharmaraj, who's known for his just spot on religious principles, that in itself adds a further quality to it. So yeah, so they're the six reasons that we generally will consider. And there's a little bit of extra background to that. Six reasons for and six reasons against. All right. Now, let's... Hare Krishna. Take it away. We're going to do an evaluation now, an overall look at that. So, for those who just come in, we just looked at a little bit more detail. Put that chair there. We just looked at the six main reasons why Ashwatthama should be executed, six reasons why he shouldn't, and we've looked at some background information based on the Acharyas, and looked at those verses in a little bit more detail. We covered that last time we met, just a little bit more information here so we get the proper understanding. Any questions before we move on? Everyone happy? So then we will summarise, we'll evaluate this. Again, we looked at this last time to some degree. How was Krishna involved in deciding Ashwatthama's punishment? And we see that in verse 52, in that seventh chapter, that Krishna heard arguments for and against. But he acted as Chaturbhuja, you know, representing one side. You've got Bhima, you know, ready to, you can imagine, as Bhurujan describes in his book, Unveiling His Lotus Feet, that, you know, you can imagine Bhima, you know, ready to kill Ashwatthama, and Draupadi trying to protect him. So Krishna is restraining both of them in his forearm form. He's manifest two arms to hold them back. So in this way, he's you know, he's hearing arguments for and against, and certainly holding back, protecting everybody from each other, keeping peace. How is the dilemma resolved? In verse 56 we say that he was simultaneously killed and not killed. Now, most importantly, of course, is how is this relevant for us? That Krishna tests his devotee's sense of duty. He wants... this was shown in verse 40. In verse 55, we see that Krishna wants us to be able to make compromises according to time, place and circumstance without transgressing religious principles. Very important principle. As far as preaching and theological application, there are some... these are some of the things we can discuss a little bit more, especially this bottom one. But, you know, in verse 36 we saw that there was violence carried out on religious principles is a Vedic concept which many people who have a false sense of religion and spiritual life, as soon as you introduce the concept of violence, they feel that, you know, it cannot be religious, it cannot be good, it cannot be spiritual. But actually, according to the actual, you know, real religious principles, violence carried out on religious principles are a necessary and proper. So, it's quite a big topic of discussion. The death sentence by the state. Another, you know, something very controversial. And consequences of animal killing. We see that one who gives permission, one who kills the animal, who sells the slaughtered animal, who cooks it or distributes it or eats it, each of those six persons are equally implicated in the death of that animal, and each of them will have to suffer the consequences of that. So these are theological. I mean, you know, all of these things actually society should be applying by law through the government and through the educational system, and yet you'll find that each of those principles there is not being followed in most places, and is highly controversial, and they're making laws really according to the sentiments of people who do not actually know the proper behaviour of action. So, you know, these theological and preaching applications, these are the sort of things that, as a society, we would hope that for the proper running of society, that these things are discussed in higher circles amongst the leaders of the country, amongst the educationists, and we should fully understand them, so that we can introduce these things to others. I know that, even this first one, violence carried out in religious principles, even among devotees, I know sometimes, beginning devotees who sometimes come to a Bhagavad Gita class or a Srimad Bhagavatam class, and when some aspect has come up about violence and you've mentioned it, they've completely lost them. You know, they just cannot relate to it, and some people have just, you know, never come back. It's such a strongly held opinion that, you know, violence is just wrong in itself. You know? So these are things, of course, that should be they're nicely discussed. We should be able to. The point is that each of you should be able to explain these things, you know, and quite confidently. You should understand them and be able to explain them. academic integrity. This is one we're going to look at in a little bit more depth.
I could not understand what is the violence carried out on religious principles.
Yes.
What are the religious principles?
that certain people should be punished with violence. And in order to keep law and order, sometimes violence is necessary. If someone came in here and wanted to kill people, what would you do? Would you just say, oh, well, I won't use violence against this person because violence is wrong? Or would you pick up a chair and whack him over the head and consider that what you've done is actually proper in the eyes of God and the law? You know, this is that someone asked Gandhi that if, because he had his Ahimsa movement, they asked him that if someone came and they were going to rape your daughter, what would you use violence? And he said no. That is actually against the religious principles. For him to stand by and not utilise violence and let someone rape his daughter, he cannot call that religious. The religious principle would be to use violence and stop that person.
That's
why you hit them with a chair. You may not kill them, but you certainly hurt them. You know, you could hit them with a hammer, but that may kill them. But again, violence on religious principles, as you say, how much violence? These things have to be discussed. But before we even get to that point, a person has to know that violence is acceptable, and then further conversation, how much violence? If someone comes in, you know, someone walks in, takes your book and runs up the hallway, we all chase him and give him a hide, and, you know, beat the living daylights out of him. That's not good.
There's this kind of thing exhibited in Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yes.
Exactly.
Kalki.
For the future.
Yeah, he did it in the past as well. Lord Chaitanya, when Jagai and Madai attacked Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya was going to kill them.
But he didn't kill them.
No, because Nityananda begged him. You know, that if you kill them, you'll have to kill everyone in this Kali Yuga because they're all of the same quality. He was not wrong in they deserve to be punished and killed. Here, Ashwatthama. That's a good example. Ashwatthama, of course, you know, that's there are six good reasons. Krishna himself said kill him. All of these reasons are valid. Where are we? No, on the next page. Yeah. One, he was an aggressor, according to one who attacks you with the intent to kill. He's an aggressor. He's one of the six types of aggressors who you can kill. And Arjun promised Draupadi that yes, I will kill that person. Arjun was correct in doing that because Ashwatthama hadn't finished. He was intent on killing. So therefore, he was a very heinous person. And then he wanted to kill the embryo within the womb. You know, such a person, is not, deserves to be killed for the protection of the entire society. Krishna ordered that he be killed, on these various grounds that he'd killed innocent boys in their sleep. According to the laws of karma, of course. And Arjuna is right in killing him because he's killed members of his own family, you know, and Bhima and Krishna so advise him. All those reasons are valid. So that's violence carried out on religious principles. Yudhisthira, who is Dharmaraj, confirmed it. That yes, there's nothing irreligious. Well, actually, he confirmed the other way. He said that he shouldn't be killed. Draupadi said he shouldn't be killed. Arjuna thought that he shouldn't be killed and was confirmed by Yudhisthira and Draupadi. Krishna played both sides. Because you see that in the beginning Krishna was saying, yes, kill him. But then later on, you know, he's sort of confirming that, yes, you know, what Draupadi and Yudhisthira, you know, is correct. So, so he definitely deserved to be killed. And as we see, they killed him and not killed him at the same time. But there was an act of violence against Ashwatthama in that punishment. Well, they bound him and they cut off his jewel and his hair and what have you. That is, an act of bullying. If you did that in the schoolyard, you can get sued. So, they did commit some violence against him, against his person. You know, if you do that to someone now, you can get in serious trouble. That's enough violence to, you know, cause a huge amount of trauma to a person, which they did. They totally humiliated him, totally, emotionally, but physically they allowed him to live. So the violence was still there. But it was violence carried out on religious principles because they toned down from death to something that was equal to death, but it did not punish, it did not cause harm to other pious persons related to Ashwatthama. His mother had a respect for his father, so they were not actually, they would have been quite thankful that he was shown some mercy and not just killed. Now, Ashwatthama himself, of course, it's mentioned in one of the Puranas that he was then told by Krishna, he was further punished by Krishna, that he would wander the earth for 3,000 years as a wretch, and through the various jungles and what have you. He was just, he lost all his strength and all his faculties, he was reduced to just a useless human being to some degree. And he was cursed to wander the earth for 3,000 years like that and suffer pitiably in those, nothing good would come his way for those 3,000. He suffered greatly for 3,000 years wandering the earth and Krishna holding back anything enjoyable for his life. And but of course, having then been completely purified of that of his sinful reactions, he does become one of the seven sages in the next Manu. So therefore, there was he was purified, allowed to live, and even so purified that he actually become elevated. So certainly his parents, would have been happy at the end result that he didn't just get killed and, punished in, life after life for that as well without any prospect of elevation. So, violence was certainly part of the punishment, but it was done according to religious principles that considered how it impacted everyone involved. So a compromise was made, and that's what that is. This point here, violence carried. That's why this pastime is very, very important for if the leaders of the world and educationists want to study violence on religious principles, they can draw so much. The compromises, it's not like in some places like the Taliban and what have you. Some places in the world, there is a violent punishment for a death, but they don't consider, properly how it affects others, and therefore there's not compromises made when, according to time, place and circumstances, the punishment is sometimes breaking other religious principles by causing other people, innocent people, to suffer. So much can be actually learned from this pastime. It's very important. So therefore it has a wonderful theological application. And because it's presented in a story form, it's very palatable to hear for people, and to be able to picture the story means that very difficult concepts are very easily grasped. So one can very easily imagine Draupadi pleading that don't let his mother cry like I am doing. So one can very easily see that a punishment should not necessarily cause suffering to others, but forming that picture within your mind is very helpful to see that. So it's a wonderful story like that. Death sentence by the state that a person who commits certain crimes that are punishable by death, they, of course, by that capital punishment, their punishment is affected in this life. Not only do they not have to suffer in the next life, but in fact they can even be elevated through that punishment to go to the heavenly planets. So it is such a complete purification that it is possible that that person can then go to the heavenly planets after that punishment. But certainly the death penalty is there, and Prabhupada tells a story that even in his time, he knows that he saw two brothers. They fought with each other, and one of the brothers killed the other one. And so he was sentenced to death. And the mother and father pleaded that, we have lost one son, so if you, if you punish him with the death sentence, which, then we've lost both sons. And they let him go. So, it's part of the same thing, that the death sentence applies, and sometimes it will be enacted because all parties agree and are not concerned, they understand it's the best. And in other circumstances, so for instance, had they had, 5 or 6 sons or something like that, they may not have revoked the death penalty, but the fact that they would lose their only 2 sons, their only 2 children, meant that they did. So compromises are needed.
Taken to the heavenly planet, he can be purified and he can be going to heavenly planet instead of suffering. So in such a bad condition for 3,000 years, will that not be better for the parents to see that one rather than see this one?
We see that not necessarily. It would depend on the parent, you know, that you know, some mothers would, you know, prefer that let what comes in the future come, but let him not die now while I'm present, you know. So that's it may not necessarily be the best scenario, but Draupadi's sons, we told the story last week, of course her sons were the Vishvadevas, five Vishvadevas I think, who were cursed, took birth as the five. They, upon being killed, they went back to their positions in the heavenly planets as well. But Draupadi still considered the great suffering that she felt, even though, you know, that she didn't want to inflict that upon Ashwatthama. you know, if you consider all points that one, you know, a mother may be happy that you know, my son's he could go to the heavenly planet, but you know, this terrible mentality has not been taken from his heart. And you know, she may be happy that if that's what it takes to get this evil out of his heart, and then he becomes an exalted soul, then fair enough, let him not be killed. Let this horrible, heinous nature be purified with what, you know, they see to be fit, and then, you know, he attains, you know, to becomes one of the seven great sages. So in the long run, you know, weighing up everything, you know, everyone considered that that was, you know. Not necessarily. They don't all go to the heavenly planets. It's possible. It's possible that you can, that a person can go to the heavenly planets. It's not that everyone who gets it goes. It's just there are examples of it to show how effective it is. Right? That's the point that stated. There's the Shastric verses that show that it is possible. But it's not that everyone goes to the heavenly planets. Some of them actually, even after that, that they may be purified from that particular reaction in that lifetime, but there may be you know, many, many lifetimes of sinful reactions still to come, in, you know, what have you. So you know, in Ashwatthama's case, by the grace of the Lord, he's actually being purified of everything totally, completely, to the point where he becomes one of the great seven great sages in the universe. So you know, there's a lot of benefit being meted out there. And yeah, but we, you know, we may not know all the details, but we're, you know, from what we do know, we have to consider that here Krishna, Yudhisthira, Dharmaraj, you know, Draupadi, and you know, everyone involved with all of their, you know, vast knowledge and understanding, compassion and good qualities, that they're taking into account that for everyone's benefit, and yet still this has to be the punishment, this is the best. Like that. So there is a compromise was needed, and this was the best for Ashwatthama's benefit, the you know, not create an offence against the Brahminical community and that family of Brahmanas in particular, like that, to set the right precedence, and you know, for law and order, everything considered, that was the best compromise. And yet they didn't just let him off scot-free where there's no punishment, and that would upset a lot of people also. Abhima. So we come to this here. Any other questions or comments you want to have with them? Alright, academic integrity. This is what we need, more women coming in the door. So we even at the numbers, at 2, 4, 5. We're still in men are still outnumbering. We're 2, 4, 7. Alright. Okay. Let's take the following statement by Srila Prabhupada. And let's see how this can be easily misused. The statement is in the purport to verse 42. Women as a class are no better than boys, and therefore they have no discriminatory power like that of a man. Prabhupada's intention from the same purport, that we should not follow the mild nature of a woman and thereby accept that which is not genuine. That's his intention in making that statement. Not that we should disregard the statement, but we should understand also the attempt behind the statement. And Ashvatthama is not as good as a genuine Brahmana. That's part of Prabhupada's intention, you know. You know, one of Draupadi's, let's have a look at one of Draupadi's first statements. What verse would we look at for that? Pundits and scholars. What's that? I think it's 43, is it? Here are we? Chapter 8. Chapter 7. In 43, she says she could not tolerate Ashvatthama's being bound by ropes, and being a devoted lady, she said, "Release him, for he is a Brahmana, our spiritual master." So, now, we looked at in verse 43, we see that the acharyas have seen her faithfulness to Dharma, that she's, you know, her statement is a pious statement. You know, the Dharmic principles is, you know, be very, very careful not to insult or cause harm, you know, to a Brahmana. So she's being faithful to that principle. So her motivation is pious and faithful to the principles of religion. So she can't be faulted on that. And Yudhisthira applauded this religious nature of hers and faithfulness to Dharma. And we see, you know, I think that's in the purport, devotees are never unkind even to their enemy. So, you know, this is the good qualities of a saintly person. Even an enemy. So there's no fault in any of that. But there is one thing, and that is she's actually saying that, you know, release him, for he is a Brahmana, our spiritual master. And that is not correct. Because Prabhupada's point here is, you know, he is saying that Ashvatthama is not as good as a genuine Brahmana. You know, by you know, it doesn't take a lot to see that the actions of Ashvatthama did not show the qualities of a Brahmana. you know, a Brahmana is religious by nature. And, you know, we see in the Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter, the qualities of Brahmana. Who knows that off by heart? There's, there's religiousness is one of them anyway. So, his activities were totally irreligious. You know, there's a, you know, one is faithful to Shastra and to the Supreme Lord. You know, that is not there. You know, there's tolerance and peacefulness and, you know, control of the mind and senses. He's acting out of, you know, envy and revenge and, you know, none of these qualities are there within the quality of the Brahma. You know, the qualities of Brahma are not manifesting in his heart or his activities. So he's not actually a genuine Brahmana. But neither is Draupadi wrong in her, you know, pious nature, her religious nature, and her, you know, faithfulness to the Dharma. But there is a certain mildness. That does not allow her to make that discrimination, which is actually necessary, that he's not a genuine Brahmana, and therefore, you know, what she's asking for does not apply to him. It would apply to a Brahmana, but it doesn't apply to him. So, you know, there is something there, and it is born out of a nature's soft heart, their quality. But it's also born out of, you know, piousness and religiousness. So it's not a fault, as we said, it's just, you know, the mild nature of a woman is a good quality, especially when it's, you know, has a religious tone to it. But at the same time, something else needs to be there in order to make these, you know, that soft nature cannot override a fact and take something as not genuine, you know, and that's what happened there. So therefore, you know, Prabhupada's intention is saying that, in essence, a young boy would do the same thing. Alright? You know, so, you know, a young boy has a similar, you know, mildness. Very hard for a young boy to make decisions like that. It depends on the boys, of course, and even here it depends on the women. You know, the mildness of a woman, we'll take it generally for women. I think that's acceptable. But of course, you know, there are variations. And the same for young boys, you know, there are variations of their, you know, but generally we can understand that a young boy, his ability to make a real harsh decision because of his soft nature and mild nature is going to be nowhere near, you know, an adult man in the same situation. You know, and then, you know, within that there are, you know, maximum and minimum. So again, on this point we see that I'll just put a little note here that Draupadi's discrimination of Aswatthama as a Brahmana, that may be questionable, but of course not a good qualities. Vama Swabhava, that's what it's called, a woman's mild nature, mild and gentle. So she was actually supported, you know, in the majority of her argument. It was supported by Krishna and the others, and they glorified her, you know, wonderful qualities. You know, which is a very important point here. In other words, we're asking, how can this be misused? Okay, so because women have a mild nature and sometimes that can affect the discrimination in a hard decision, so let's take them out of the decision making process. That's one way it can be misused. But which would be wrong, because we see that everyone supported her decision, and Otherwise, he may have been killed quite quickly. Hello. So let's have some thoughts. So I've given one way that may be misused, that for instance we may wrongly think that women have no business in authoritative judgments, so which would be wrong, because we see here that she was very much the driving force, behind the compromise that was eventually made. So she was very much part of this decision-making process. We don't see anyone, Yudhisthira, Krishna, even Bhima, who was extremely angry, saying, you're just a woman, stay out of it. Huh? So other ways that may be misused. Take from the women. You mean keep quiet. No, go on. Don't let me do all the talking. I'm in the hot seat here. I was just going to say personal experiences in this. It's funny because I went and visited my elder daughter yesterday, and she told me a funny story that some of you may have seen my elder daughter. She has blonde hair. Now, of course, there's a running joke amongst men that if someone is blonde, they don't think very intelligently, right? A lot of men see a blonde woman and they immediately discriminate. That's a fact in Western society. She's, she looks like a little girl. She's, sort of short and sort of she's about 28, but she looks like a little girl. So, probably to me anyway. anyway, she just got promoted and she's in charge of, a few people. And one of the things they do, of course, is suicide assessment, trying to prevent people from suicide and what have you. So she went to a meeting, and of course she was the only woman there, and they were all men, big, tall men, dressed in their suits and what have you, and of course she comes in. So when she sat down, they said to her, feel free to make any contributions if you think you've got anything, But just even the way they said it, it was like, you probably don't have much, to say. But if you want to say something for the hell of it, feel free to do it. So that was the sort of tone. So anyway, she sat there and she just listened, and they, discussed so many things for a while. And then she said, I may have a little comment. And she brought up, a few points. She said, one, there's no structure to this, your whole, she was quite soft-spoken about it, but there's no structure to your whole plan. This, and they've been doing this thing for 3 years, and they admitted, no, there's no structure. They didn't have. She basically just pointed out that they had no solutions, no structure, and although they'd been working on it, they were getting no results and what have you. So, just and they all agreed, and they unanimously sort of took up her instructions. Of course, one of the things is she takes the trouble to. Do the proper studies, in the research and everything like that, and she's quite an intelligent person. So it was very interesting because their immediate stereotype reaction was that here's this young girl, you know, she's not really going to have much of an input. Whereas she, within just a few moments, established herself as the leader of the group. And they accepted that, overwhelmingly. There was no fuss, it was, you know, they were quite happy. And of course, you know, we can see that, this is a very emotional type, you know, suicide, you know, dealing with people with suicide, a very difficult sort of an area, you know, so one may think that, there are stereotypes that may think that, women may or may not be fit, you know, for certain decision-making processes, which is a misuse of this statement, and at the same time, it should be understood the general nature of a woman, you know. It's not that we should totally neglect that men and women are just exactly the same. No difference at all. You know, that's preposterous, you know, to make that. In general, you know, so there's a general understanding. So both things, you know, have to be taken. But in general, this statement here is very, very much, very easily, misused within ISKCON. And also, not just within ISKCON, of course, those who are not within ISKCON, who would read something like that, would just immediately, freak out. You know, it's quite a controversial statement. You know, one of the other points that, of course, you know, I consider here that I was thinking about, and it probably shows up in the example I gave with my daughter, is that in this age of Kali, we know that everyone is born Sudra or less. So, you know, we know that there's a distinction between you have Brahmanas, Kshatriyas. Brahmanas and Kshatriyas are considered, you know, higher class in the sense that their intelligence is more purified, their knowledge is more vast, their qualifications in many different aspects of life are, you know, superior. The Vaishyas, the Sudras and women and Brahma Bandhus are taken as a whole, as you know, that is the next rung of the level, taken as a whole. In Kali Yuga, the distinction between the higher and the next level is not there, because they're all in that one class. So therefore, you know, if you go back 5,000 years in time, this principle is not so difficult to see, because there is such a distinction between, you know, their qualification and this qualification. It'd be so distinct, so easily to understand. Someone who, you know, tries to dance, you know, we see they have dancing and singing, you know. You know, some people are just so expert, and another person just, you know, cannot dance. You know, they just look like a bit of a... There's such a big distinction. In Kali Yuga, the distinction between this high and low class has all but merged. So therefore, it's very difficult for women, of course, to accept that they're, you know, and you know, rightly so, that their way of thinking is much different to men in the age, because it's actually, you know, come, you know, the men in this age, even grown men, are on the same level. The distinction has disappeared. So therefore, men are more wrong in this day and age by making that distinction, because in many cases, the level of men has come down way, you know, to the animal level. So, you know, there's human women, there's human men, and then there's hogs, dogs, camels and asses. in the two-legged form. And so for a man to be thinking, oh, you know, I'm a man, you're a woman, you know, somehow or another there's a, you know, I'm on a higher level, when actually they're on the level of an animal, and here's a, you know, a woman with, you know, one, at least human qualities, or two, saintly qualities, would be wrong. So there's a lot of different factors involved here where this statement can certainly be just taken without any real, you know, understanding. Any other comments or thoughts on that? Can we just hit that middle one? I just sort of get in my eyes.
To say that women are no better than boys. I mean, I can understand that they may not have a lot of power to be aggressive with their decisions compared to an adult male, but why is it necessary to sort of compare to a boy? I'm lost on that.
Well, because a young boy, the reason Prabhupada is making the comparison is to show that in general an adult male, their process of discrimination is nowhere near as, you know, their discriminatory power is not diminished by a mild nature as a boy's nature is. And I think that's obvious to everyone, you know, that a boy's nature, their discriminatory power, because they are still, they're male, but they're a boy, it is not the same as, you know, that of a male adult. So in other words, here it's saying, you know, that therefore, you know, women, even as adults, and young boys, there is a comparison to the how their discriminatory power is affected by their mild nature. There is a similarity.
But to me, that says that women don't mature, that women, as they develop, they don't become more discriminatory and possibly more likely to stick to their guns, so to speak. So it's saying, like, women are permanently mature, like boys.
No, they mature, but even though the maturity is going, you know, so we take it from a young girl, you know, if we take a young girl's discriminatory power compared to an adult woman's discriminatory power, there's a difference, which means that they have matured. But even though that maturity is there, still as an adult woman, the mild nature will affect the discriminatory power to some degree, that you know, they may make a similar decision as a young boy in a hard pressed case such as this.
Now, but here Draupadi was making, according to Krishna, she was making the right. In fact, she was supported by everybody else.
Yep.
That she had made the right decision. That her decision of not wanting to come on her, it's maybe as she is a gentle woman and she's, the emotion part of it is there. She didn't want the clan, their clan to be affected further. Or whatever, but it was supported. But still, why did
Prabhupada
give that comment?
Okay, who would agree amongst the men or the women that Draupadi made her decision on emotional basis? You would agree?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. And yourself? And you're not? Yeah? You are? For what reason?
Her ability to judge is
is not as good as if she had not been a woman. You know, in the very fact that she's by nature women are emotional, and in certain situations and circumstances they take decisions from their heart, not from their head. That's the reason I think that's why.
So yeah, and I'm asking, so you don't think that she used her head and her heart? It was just purely emotional? So let's look again. Let's take her arguments. One, you know, she's saying they're never unkind even to an enemy, and here it is because, you know, she's you know, because she says, release him because he's a brahmana or a guru. Now, of course, we see the emotional side, the mild side, did affect the discriminatory power in this one because she accepted him as a genuine brahmana when he wasn't. So the discrimination was compromised, okay? And so we can accept it there. We'll have a look at the next one. The son represents the absent father, Drona. Is that...
That's true.
Yes. No, but I'm saying, is that just emotional or rational?
It's emotional.
Or both?
Both.
There is rationality in there. It's actually a good argument.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a... It's not like just emotional blurting. That's a solid argument.
Yeah.
You know, it's a solid rational argument and logical. And good use of, you know, scripture. But it's probably still, we say, driven by emotion. But there's rationality there. It's not purely emotion. For her to say something completely ridiculous means that there's just emotion there. But she's saying things which are, you know, let Drona's wife not cry like me. Okay, but it is emotional, but there's a lot of rationality in it, huge amounts of rationality, because it represents a quality of being, non-duplicitous and equal. That equal means that she's thinking that, you know, I'm a woman who's lost my children, I know how this has affected me, and she's also a woman, so she's really considering her position, you know, as a woman with a child. So, you know, there's sort of rational thought in that, in considering her position.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
because there's only emotion. She'll say, "Okay, I'm suffering. Let her suffer."
Yeah, I'm suffering. You know, let stop this. Suffer. You know, like that. But she's actually
She's thinking rationally. Okay, I have suffered. Let her not suffer. That's
mm-hmm.
the rationality.
Yeah.
Emotional statement would be there, okay, I have suffered, so she should suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I think there's emotion and rational. You know, so we've got those ones from, you know, Draupadi. The son represents the absent father, which is applied in two ways. One's as a matter of correctness to Drona, who they're indebted to, which is a rational thought. And two, out of, you know, mercy. So, you know. It shows a rational understanding of Varnashram culture and the very foundation of it. You know, the Brahmanas, without, you know, the Brahmanas are the very basis of, you know, that's why we say, Namo Brahmanya Devaya, Go Brahmanya Taicha, Digiditae Krishna Govindaya Namo Namaha. If you protect the cows and the Brahmanas, you protect the entire Varnashram system. And by destroying the Brahmanas and the cows, you destroy the entire Varnashram system. So it is quite a rational understanding of the whole Varnashram system. So, do you still think it is just purely emotional?
Emotional in the sense that she is, of course, intelligent.
Yes.
In
part of it, yes, part of it was there is her rationality and emotion blend nicely in most of these arguments, but it does fail her by accepting something that's not genuine. It does fail her discriminatory power at some point. Which is again an interesting point. It's not that because that mild nature is there, that we just accept that everything that's said is just emotional and unrational. You know, the 90% of what she has presented should be accepted as rational thought. But the point that accepting, you know, the very first statement that, you know, let him go, release him, he's a brahmana, our spiritual master. Would you accept such a spiritual master? You know? You would?
Probably, yeah.
You'd accept Ashwatthama as your spiritual master?
Possibly. Yeah. I think there's a lot of things that suggest that you've got to forgive your spiritual master if he makes a mistake. And,
yes.
That devotees do bad things to other devotees, but they're still devotees.
Yeah. How bad can we get? And you'll still love us, hey? So, you know,
that's the degree of it. So that's what the sort of so it, the principle
yeah.
is.
Right.
I'm saying the principle is that, you know, he is spiritual master. So he's done something like very bad. But in principle, in my logical mind,
he's like, still the spiritual master, and acceptable. Like okay. So, you know, what you're saying is that, you know, in treating the spiritual master, certainly if a very exalted person commits some mistakes, they're not treated the same as an ordinary person, so that's correct, you know, that's rational. We have to take into consideration all the good things that they have done, and possibly, you know, that with reformation, all the good things that they can do. So all these things are here. Would you accept that there is a point where, you know, it is inexcusable and a person cannot be accepted as a spiritual master at some point?
That's
right. It is a very... This is where our discriminatory power has to not balk away from a very difficult decision. According to our mild nature, we have to quite, you know, strongly challenge these. Because, now, you know, we can imagine the situation, of course, is that the situation which exists now in the world is that all the so-called gurus of the world, most of them are practically debauchees, and you know, people do accept them because of their, you know, sentimental, approach to the situation, and the result is, the people who follow them. They go to hell. They don't get misguided. They take birth in the animal species of life. Because it means that by accepting a false guru, you engage in your you take sinful life as a religious process, and you have you can justify any irreligious activity. And all those irreligious activities you will suffer for in one different lower species of life or another, and plus many of them will actually have to suffer in hellish regions. So the danger is, of course, is that these people may suffer terribly. You know, we see people now in war-torn countries, poverty-stricken countries. These people are taking birth as a result of heinous sinful activities in past life, where they take birth and their life is suffering from start to finish. So by accepting false guru and overshadowing the path of, you know, what is proper, we condemn everyone to a many lifetimes of suffering. So that one person can sit in an exalted seat and be called the guru, and we don't want to offend him, how many thousands of people will we send to hell? Do we, you know, when we have pedophilia, you know, when children are, you know, molested and their entire life becomes one where just they're on the brink of suicide day in, day out for the rest of their life until they eventually do commit suicide. Do we allow, do we just, you know, sentimentally forgive that, oh, you're a priest, you're a brahmana, you know, we shouldn't be too mean to you, but who cares about all your victims?
So even the persons who's following are not doing those deeds, but are accepting such a guru, also they go through all those sufferings.
Yep. Therefore, Bhishma, all the people who allowed Draupadi to be, they attempted to disrobe her and see her naked, they all had to be killed. In fact, all of those millions of people suffered because the leaders were not challenged. In other words, if someone had it challenged, you call yourselves the leaders, you know, Bhijma, you're supposed to be the grandsire of this. You sit there and watch this woman beat his robe? How dare you sit there and call yourself a leader? If someone had a challenge, you know, how many millions of people died in the Battle of Kurukshetra as a result of their offence to Draupadi? Millions. Millions. Because it's such a chaste lady. So we can either not offend personalities like Bhishma, or we can stand up and say, this is wrong, you're our leader, but you're no longer fit to be our leader, and save millions of people being slaughtered in the Battle of Kurukshetra. So, you know, there's a... so, you know, they're hard decisions, and you know, when you get to them, of course, you know, someone needs to be punished for a crime, and then you think, well, you know, this person's got their own family, of course, and then we're going to punish them, and their children will suffer. You know, these are very, very difficult decisions, but they have to be faced strongly for the benefit of everyone, you know, concerned, and compromises need to be made. You know, but not compromised to the point where justice is not done, and you know, a whole family will suffer. So therefore, Chanaka Pandit says, for the sake of you know, the country, you may sacrifice a village. For the sake of the village, you may sacrifice a family. For the sake of the family, you may sacrifice one person. And for the sake of your soul, you can sacrifice everything. So, these are principles that are there. But now, just want to get a last show of hands. Who still thinks that Draupadi's statements were purely emotionally motivated? Right? Okay? Who thinks they are purely rational? Purely rational? No emotion.
Combination?
Yeah? A lot of rationality, like a majority of rational, but still a strong emotional, mild emotional nature. Yeah. So, in order to make that decision, in order to properly discriminate that, okay, wonderful what you said, but he's not a brahmana. You know, that has to be understood. Someone who can make that decision without being compromised by their soft nature needs to do that. In general, and as we said, in previous ages, this distinction was quite a lot clearer. In this age, it's all but merged. Okay? But you know, as a general rule, to some small degree, it is there in a qualified man and a qualified woman, you will see this distinction. Therefore, here we're dealing with, you know, qualified people of this time. Qualified people in this day and age, a qualified woman and a qualified man, you will see a slight distinction which will represent this principle. But it can't properly be applied to unqualified men versus a qualified woman. Nor an unqualified woman versus a qualified man, because an unqualified woman can sometimes be totally, you know, off the planet, you know. And so the same with an unqualified man. So you really, you know, to really pull out that principle, it is still there, and therefore within ISKCON, where we are trying to make men and women qualified, it's applicable. And as society follows the principles of ISKCON, it will become more applicable into society. But in many cases, it's not.
But even in our society, once a woman becomes, or a living entity in a woman's body becomes completely pure, then she shouldn't be affected by any of these.
Yes, but she will still have her a purified soul still has their eternal nature, and therefore you see that, you know, even. You know, amongst Krishna's gopis, you know, there are left wing and right wing, right wing, that some gopis support Krishna and some gopis support Radharani. So some of the gopis will chastise Krishna and can't see any wrong in what he does when he takes off with Chandravali, and some gopis, you know, chastising quite strongly. So even in our eternal nature, you know, and so there are differences there within the gopis, and then Krishna's friends also, and the difference between the boys and the girls, the gopis and the gopis, there are distinctions. So you know, although one becomes a pure devotee of the Lord, you know, there are still you know, those whose nature is mild and others whose nature is stronger, more biting, even on the spiritual platform. So we're not, so, you know, and as you say, as you correctly said, that Draupadi in this case, she is the right person, you know, to represent this mild nature. Perhaps because that mild nature is there, you know, even in her spiritual identity. And, you know, others are representing the more, you know, stronger nature, and perhaps that is shown even in their spiritual identity. We see, for instance, to give you an example, that Lalita Shakhi, who has, you know, quite a strong nature, she will chastise Krishna. She appeared as Swarup Damodar, who was Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's personal secretary. So she was very sharp, very, very harsh, strong, you know, in one sense, that anyone, in Lord Chaitanya's movement, she actually represents the quality of criticism, constructive criticism, that she was very critical and would pick out, you know, straight away, very strongly, very harshly. Someone would come to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that, here is my commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. And she would, oh, you know, you are, you know, unchaste, you know. You know, we cannot even show this to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You know, this is an offence. So you take this away and, you know, you go and hear from Vaishnavas for some time, and then you, you know, you learn how to be chaste to the acharyas, and then perhaps, you know. So she was very strong, very crude. She wouldn't even let them approach Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that, you know, nature that she has, in the spiritual world made her the right person to represent a male person in the spiritual world with just a harsh, stronger nature. So, you know, Draupadi, for one reason or another, she is the correct person on the spiritual platform to represent the mild nature of women, and, you know, like that. Is that right?
Prabhu, I had a different question. They said that a pure Vaishnava has, in fact, is very soft-hearted.
Mm.
It's nothing to do with the male or female. The more the person is a Vaishnava, he is soft-hearted.
Yes.
Mm. And forgiving.
Mm.
In fact, they give so many examples like Jesus Christ when he was crucified, he was saying, please forgive me. These people, they don't know what they are doing. I did not start with that, what he did. He said, God, forgive it. They don't know what they are doing. So when you're talking on a Vaishnava level,
yes,
you're talking at a different level. They said they are most forgiving, they are most mild.
That's right.
Where the discrimination comes there.
No, still, you know, although they're all unlimitedly merciful and soft-hearted, a Vaishnava is described as, you know, soft as a rose and hard as a thunderbolt. so therefore, you know,
so he knows when to be soft and when to be hard.
Yes, because
he can discriminate.
Out of their compassion, sometimes a Vaishnava, you know, they're so compassionate that they will not accept disciples. It is their soft-hearted nature, you know. It appears like, you know, we know that Guru Kishore Das Babaji was so disgusted, you know, with the state of people in Kali Yuga, including all the so-called saintly persons and the so-called devotees. He was so disgusted that he just, you know, would not prominently preach or accept disciples. But that harsh behavior, which he quite often showed in many different ways, was actually, you know, one way, that is his way that he showed his soft-hearted compassion. So what he did, of course, was, you know, it appears to be harsh, but he prayed that, you know, people are so fallen, and, you know, he was so disgusted with people, that he felt that he was incapable of acting as a spiritual master in one sense. So he prayed for someone who would come, and you know, be capable of you know, delivering them. So therefore, you know, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, of course, you know, appeared and became his disciple, and literally manifested the soft-hearted side of Guru Kishore Das Babaji on his behalf. So they're all soft-hearted, even when they display harshness. It doesn't mean that when a Vaishnava is harsh, it is a manifestation of their soft-heartedness as well. You know, so some, you know, Vaishnavas manifest that soft-hearted, that compassionate nature by being as hard as a thunderbolt, you know, in the majority of times. That's their compassion. You know, get out of here, you rascal. Don't ever come back. You know, that can be their compassion. You know, for different reasons. We see that Ramchandra Puri, who was a disciple of Madhavendra Puri, at Madhavendra Puri's, you know, when Ishwar Puri, disciple of Ishwar Puri, when Ishwar Puri was passing away, Ramchandra Puri came and criticized him, thinking, you're lamenting for Radha Krishna, you know, you should be, you know, on the platform of Brahman, you know, what's his lamentation? You know, you should be free from any lamentation. And he, you know, he told him, you get out of here, don't show your face, don't ever, you know, come back. Staying meant that he would just commit more and more offences, and you know, you'll see that, like when a Vaishnava goes somewhere and people are very offensive, the Vaishnava leaves for the benefit of those people. Because if they stay and continue to, it just increases the suffering for everyone, for the entire town, everything. So out of their mercy, seeing that the offences will not stop or they'll escalate or continue, they leave. That's their mercy. It seems to be very harsh. So, you know, all Vaishnavas have that soft-hearted mercifulness. Some of them need to exhibit it in the, as the hard thunderbolt, and some of them exhibit that soft-heartedness, you know, in other ways. But, you know, it's not that we say that one Vaishnava, Guru Kishore Das Babaji, wasn't very soft-hearted. He just exhibited that soft-hearted, merciful nature in that way, which was for everyone's benefit. Someone had to show disgust. You know? Like, the activities of the so-called sadhus, that someone had to show disgust. You know, what you were doing in the name of, you know, being a Vaishnava is, you know, I will kill myself, it is so disgusting. Someone has to let them know. Okay, so then they understand, then someone can come and pick up the pieces and, okay, what have we done wrong? Well, yes, this is what you've done wrong, and preach to them and get them onto the platform. So, you know, it's necessary. But it's a very hard, you know, again, our discriminatory power cannot be compromised when something needs to be done. So, you know, this is a general principle. It's really nice you bring up a lot of points that, you know, we have to consider how this principle is applied among devotees, you know, among advanced devotees, you know, within ISKCON, out of ISKCON. It's something that needs a lot of discussion. But when you first just read the quote, you think, hello, 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 what's, you know, there's something. You know, you could just really act emotionally to this and just put down the book and all, like that.
Why did Bhishma Dev and Dronacharya allow the discriminatory power to be compromised by emotion? I mean, they were qualified men, they're actually devotees.
Well, that's what we said, that Dvijabandhu, Vaishya, women, in general, you can take them as a group. His discrimination was... So you're saying Bhishma?
She said, well, Bhishma Dev kept quiet when Draupadi was there. Okay, because of his vow, he did it. No, but later on he says that I'm paying the price for doing that.
It's a good question. Can we car park that one? I haven't done a car park, you know, all year. Where is our car? Because we're coming up to the pastimes of Bhishma. So will we leave it to then? Because it's a big topic, that one. Do you want to write it down and bring it up? Can you write it down and just bring it up when we get to that? All right, that's good. All right. Any other comments or questions? So we're going to look at chapter 8. I might just take a break for a minute, and I'll be back in about 2 minutes. Anyone wants to have a quick break, they can.
Prabhuji, it's ready.
Can you pass that around and tell the first person to write the date?
Date.
All right, let's continue on here. So, we're looking at chapter 8, canto 1, chapter 8. Just a very quick summary of this chapter. Verses 1 to 16, Parikit Maharaj saved. Parikit Maharaj, of course, is within the womb. Verses 18 to 43, prayers of Queen Kunti. And the final part of the chapter, verses 44 to 52, Yudhisthira laments the massacre in the Battle of Kurukshetra. In the fifth verse of chapter 8, Srila Prabhupada lists five creatures, as he calls them, or personalities, who should be protected. And, you know, ISKCON, as Srila Prabhupada says, this complete outlook is based upon factors leading to the successful humanity as against the civilization of polished cats and dogs. The killing of the above five, which we'll mention in a moment, innocents, is forbidden because even by insulting them one loses one's duration of life. Very pertinent information, of course, because we've just looked at Ashwatthama. And of course the battle of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we're taking up the story in the Srimad Bhagavatam at the very end of the massacre, and we can see that because one of these principles was violated, that the chaste woman Draupadi was not protected by the leaders, and therefore it resulted in the duration of life of everyone involved being, you know, destroyed. So many people died as a result of defending the chastity of a chaste woman. Not properly, she should have been protected. You know, Draupadi, of course, should have been protected, not, you know, attempted to be disrobed by the very leaders of society. You know, such a crime. A very, very important. Brahmanas, by protecting the Brahmanas, it maintains the entire Varnashram system, as we said, and cows. Cows maintains the miracle of milk, which produces the very fine brain tissues by which we can understand the higher goal in life. Protection of women maintains the society's chastity and the children, creating good generation of children, progeny. You know, certainly if society is producing very high quality children, you've got a high quality society. You know, when the children are all very disturbed in the heart, very, you know, lacking in good qualities, very difficult to guide and train, society ends up in chaos. Protection of the elderly, which maintains you know, the elderly's best chance to prepare themselves for a better life after death. So from worm to the tomb. the protection is there, and especially the brahmanas and the cows and the women. I might ask one or two questions on these points. Okay, considering what we've just discussed, how important within ISKCON is it to avoid, to properly protect women? As you see, Srila Prabhupada saying, even by insulting them, they should be protected, even insulting them, cause the one to lose the duration of life. How do you think this applies to ISKCON? Let's take the, because we've had such a major discussion on women. How does that apply to ISKCON? And also some food for thought for discussion is how well are we actually protecting these five different types of ISKCON, innocence in ISKCON? Do you think we're ISKCON is doing a good job? Could do better? And who has some thoughts or? Just want to get a little bit of feedback. These five innocents should be protected. And we see that even insulting a chaste woman, brahmanas, any of them, what to speak of causing them harm, innocents that need to be protected, it reduces the duration of life. It causes a lot of trouble. We see that actually so many millions of people in the Battle of Kurukshetra just, annihilated because of the insult to Draupadi, the one woman. One is ISKCON fulfilling its role of protecting those? That's something we can look at, discuss. And two, let's look at that one first. Yeah.
For the children, are not doing that for the right reasons, and then therefore they're disruptive to other brahmanas, and ISKCON as such is not sorting out the people who might not be appropriate.
Right, so, yeah.
And therefore cause distress to other people who are
devoted
to service.
They may be applying this principle to those who are not genuine brahmanas, as in the case we just looked at. Yeah, good.
Yes.
No, that's good. So it's what trouble do you think that will cause? Of course,
you could distract the genuine brahmanas from their study and
Yeah. disturb actual brahmanas, disturb them. Yeah. That I guess as an example, two brahmanas maybe make a decision on something, and the genuine brahmana thinks that within the ashram this should be the standard, and the non-genuine brahmana is thinking, oh, you know, that's ridiculous, we shouldn't do that. And someone, if the authorities support the non-genuine brahmana, perhaps because he's been around a little bit longer, and the new brahmana, who's actually better qualified, is not supported, so it can be disturbing, and that person may even leave, you know. Yeah, so that's a fact. Yeah. So that's applying the principle without proper discrimination. So let's maybe we'll write some of these down. Or does this? That come on? Yeah, that comes off. Can we get a scribe? Is there a scribe in the house? And do we have a cleaner? Any volunteers? So let's sum that one up, that the one, some of the principle of protection may be being applied but without proper discrimination. So that's a good point. All right. Other things that you, that, yep. Right, so actually within the world, who's training brahmanas apart from ISKCON, you know, on such a scale, you know, and qualified? So we say that massive, you know, contribution as far as training and protecting the brahminical culture, yeah? I mean, there must be thousands of brahmanas around the world being trained by ISKCON, given protection. Without that, brahminical culture would all be lost. Even, what was there within ISKCON, what was there within India, was the brahminical culture was very fast. As we said, some of our acharyas, like Srila Guru Kishore Das Babaji, were absolutely disgusted at the state of the brahminical culture. And because Srila Prabhupada trained Westerners as brahmanas, and when they went to India, it actually revived the, you know, just general Indian interest, Indian culture in their own brahminical traditions to some degree. So it's not just within ISKCON, but, you know, within ISKCON, within India, ISKCON is having a major contribution. So yeah, that is a big point. Yeah, it's a huge contribution. Yep.
Maybe I was hearing a lecture by Bhaktivedanta Swami.
Yep.
And he mentioned all these five
protected. Yes.
He also mentioned Brahmacharis. Can you
explain? Well, brahmacharis would fit into the category of children, you know, in the early life. And of course, the early stage, you know, brahmanas are also, to become a brahman, you have to become a brahmachari. So it's sort of, to me, and of course these days we also have brahmacharinis, but to me the brahmacharis seem to fit in within a couple of those categories there. Any other? Does anyone think that there are some, you know, in any of these, women, children?
Krishna conscious schools for the children is
good. Required. It's what? It's required. More required. Yeah. So. For children, there needs to be a lot more educational, you know, protection in the form of, you know, where's the educational systems, like in Melbourne, because you've got to go to the other end of Australia, or, you know, put them in a school where you're highly doubtful about their association. So, children's education, you know, may be lacking. A lot, you know, a huge amount can be done there, huge amount. From, you know, and very young, of course. Yes. Yep. Anything else that, you know, is good or lacking? Yep. Old age care. Do we have one? I don't think. They're talking about it on the farm. Yeah, I've booked a bed. old age. Hey. Old age care. Yeah.
And some engagement for retired.
Yeah. Old age care and engagement. No, that's a good point, because what does happen is that you get your young brahmacharis, brahmacharinis, full of energy, very productive in many different ways, work hard, you know, get a lot of good, manifest a lot of good results. And what we do see is, of course, when they get married, their productiveness sometimes, not always, but or for some time, you know, setting up a house, getting the family established, getting a career established, it can all of a sudden, in the eyes of, you know, ISKCON, that may appear to be, you know, bordering on useless, you know, as far as productive, that, you know, or, you know, one time there's so much and all of a sudden now, we, you know, what are you doing for it? It can happen. It does happen. So therefore, you know, what can happen, you know, old age, of course, many of them are grihasthas at that stage. You know, they may spend in their youth the time that other people are studying, getting job qualifications, what have you, they give to ISKCON. When they need to establish a family, they've given that time, and it can be very difficult for them then to establish family, get a job, what have you. ISKCON, in one sense, is a little bit obliged to them. You've given that opportunity up for ISKCON, but now you're on your own with a great disadvantage in the workforce and what have you. So, you know, in one sense, ISKCON has to acknowledge that. Whether they're doing that, I quite often, you know, see that, you know, there's a lot more could be done. I think a lot of greenhousers starting a family can sometimes feel, especially if they're coming out of the Brahmachari ashram, Brahmacharini ashram, a little bit all of a sudden I'm on my own. You know, where's the support? So, yeah, engagement, care. So we could, you know, you said Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, they're sort of, you know, these are Grihastha Brahmanas. How many Grihastha Brahmanas do you know that, you know, can no longer feel that even though they're a Brahmana, you know, that they can feel a little bit, disenchanted because they feel a little bit worthless, even though they're a Brahmana, you know, because of the fact that they agree has to. So, you know, they're sort of within those groups, Grihasthas and Brahmacharis. Other things. That cows. What's the state of our, you know, farms in Australia? Empty? Alright, the cow sheds are, the cows are on their own. What can we say? There's a lot more can be done, isn't it? You know, there's generating that. Srila Prabhupada's idea for the restaurants, and, you know, which supports ISKCON and the temples. He wanted that the cows, you know, should give heaps of milk, and that the main thing that comes to the farm, to the cities, you know, to the restaurants and to the temples was ghee and milk products. He said, as far as fruits and vegetables, not so important. A lot of that can be just purchased locally, you know, not a big, you know, it can come from the farm, but. It sometimes cost-wise and amount of manpower, this, that, and the other, but ghee and milk products is a massive contribution to both temples and farms, and that was the main thing he wanted to come. And for that, you need cows. How much ghee in that is coming from our farm? No. In fact, we may be supplying them. I got a feeling, yeah, I think we are. That's a fact. Anyway, this is being taped, so we're not going to go into it too much, but let's say that more can be done. All right? Yeah. There are. There's about 8. When I was there in from 2002 to about 2003, there were about 40. They were very old. Our cows are some of the oldest in Australia, and we've looked after them and let them, you know, so they're sort of in two categories. They're old and they're cows. That's a fact. So, you know, protecting them, you get some extra points. There's something else I'd say, but I won't say. But what was the point? What was the question?
What breed of cows and how much milk do they make?
They don't make any milk because they're very old. What their plan is to, now that the herd has gone down to almost nil, they would like to start afresh with cows. Because, you know, on a farm, of course, the amount of cows that they had, about 30 to 40, you know, that's about maximum for that farm. and probably about 20 to 30 is a good number. But the cows that they had and the bullocks and what have you, well, the cows certainly were a bit old. So they're at the point where they can start again if they have manpower. They don't have manpower, there's not a lot of interest. You know, getting people to go out to the farm and look after the cows. You get a cow to milk, someone's going to milk it every day, twice a day.
How much does it cost to get a cow to buy?
Not a lot. It's sort of within the hundred, as far as I understand. It's not a lot. Not a lot of money. Costs you more to buy a car.
So the problem is getting people
to look after them. That's the big problem. That's the big problem. No. The big thing is to have the people to not just milk them, but to look after them. You've got to move them around the paddocks, feed them in winter when the hay runs out, stuff like that. How big's your home?
Is it?
I don't think there's any laws against it, as far as I'm aware. As long as there's no issues of ill health, that they haven't got enough room, because their hooves can make the ground too muddy. If they don't have any firm ground, they can get foot diseases. So, they need a certain amount of space. I think about an acre. I think you need 1 acre, it would be okay. As far as I understand, if you've got an acre, you've probably got enough for a cow. Yes, there's, 252 hectares or something. But you've got to remember, not all of that is suitable for the cows. Only a small percentage of that. And then amongst that, you've got to have summer paddocks, winter paddocks. Summer paddocks have got to be high. The winter paddocks, the low ones, Yes.
And very often we come across people who say that drinking cow's milk is as good as causing infection to the cows, because the way the cows are being milked these days, and it causes a lot of pain to the cow. So, and of course, we don't get our milk from the farm.
Yeah.
And then we still have to buy that kind of milk from that industry.
Well, it just shows that we need to take cow protection into our own hands and not depend upon the non-devotees, in their sort of harsh ways of treating cows. We shouldn't depend upon them for our milk.
Should we continue to drink more milk?
Yes, look, if you gave up all types of food where there was some, serious discrepancy in producing that food, you would have to give up eating and drinking. Everything, a lot of the vegetables that we import come from overseas, and the fertilizers can be from beef, from cows, if you look into it, you probably wouldn't eat anything. Everything is there'd be nothing left. There'd be nothing to eat. The only way you can actually know that what you're doing is eating foods and milks, and that is to do it yourself, is to have the farms and produce the produce, because there's just so much contamination and bad practices. In some countries, they use human stool as fertilizer for the vegetables. And we buy that from the markets when it hits our markets and then cook it up for the deities. You know, so it's you can't just pick one or two things and say you would have to stop eating and drinking in order to actually, and then you'd say yes, there's no contamination anymore. It is so, the age we live in is just so contaminated, and if you look into it, you'd be, you know, it's absolutely disgusting, very very disturbing. We, you know, we do as far as we can. And then, you know, mostly it's turn a blind eye. And the fact that, you know, we hope that, you know, Lord Chaitanya in his mercy and the deities in their mercy, you know, accept our offerings. You know, if we knew everything that we buy and its history, and then, you know, we know, if we had that in our mind when we're doing the offerings, we'd be, you know, in tears. There is so much, so much horrible stuff. So, yeah. You know, therefore we need to maintain the brahmanas who can teach people. The brahmanas teach the vaishyas how to properly do business, you know, in a pure way. Because there's no brahmanas, businessmen do all this horrible stuff. Brahmanas will take all the impure, contaminated elements out of society so that everything becomes purified, nice and godly. That's why it starts from the top. Without brahmanas, everything becomes disgusting in Kali Yuga. Putrid, contaminated, full of fault, you know, untouchable. Yeah. Any other comments, questions? So, you know, in one sense, you know, we have to be as careful as we can, but understand that there is, especially, you know, with regard to food and everything like that, there's so much we can do. And as we see, you know, with cows, aged care, children, even with, you know, brahmanas in general, there's a lot that can be done. You know. And women, of course, we didn't discuss that, but, you know, women within ISKCON, you know, how they're treated as well is probably something which, you know, it's the sort of thing... which should have a department and you know, regular meetings where they're taking shastra, they fully understand the principles, they fully understand how they're applied in ISKCON, and in fact then where women within ISKCON are in fact feel that people are misusing Prabhupada's quotes or not fulfilling the roles of ISKCON, that those matters are taken up and dealt with. It's a department in itself. Most of it's just let go. You know. So, you know, and therefore, you know, our society will be really fulfilling its role in ISKCON when the women, you know, and children, the brahmanas, the cows, all of those are fully taken care of, and they all feel, you know, very satisfied that yes, the proper protection, the proper care, you know, from beginning to end is there. But there is a lot to be done. I think, you know, there's an general understanding of the principle, but its application is really just beginning. Yeah. Okay, we've got 5 minutes to go. Let's look at 26 prayers of Queen Kundi. No, we'll leave that for another time. So that probably a good way to wrap up, you know, our discussion today. We'll leave that. Next week, what we want to do is discuss how Parikkhit Maharaj, or the little baby at that stage, the embryo, was saved within the womb. We want to discuss that a little bit, so read that, please. And we'll be, you can either take note or take a photo, as you usually do. Take it, you know, so that you have that. This is very helpful. It's a breakdown of the main topics within Queen Kunti's prayers. And really, if you get up to, you know, from verses 18 to 24. So Queen Kunti's prayers begin verse 18. They go right through to 43, but we just want to look at those first ones, up to 24, 18 to 24, read those, and the story of Parikkhit Maharaj, and we'll discuss that at length next week. I think that's about it. Yep. Any other questions or...